The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm Jean Haley, and I'm occupying this seat this morning. I'll just say a few things about me before we begin. So I never know what to say. So I'm a practitioner, I'm a mother, I'm a partner, I am a sister, I'm a daughter, not yet a grandparent. One of my roles, I teach at the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the university. I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I've been able to adapt that curriculum for people with early-stage dementia, people with traumatic brain injury. I've taught at the women's prison. So I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities to spread the Dharma. My son is also a Dharma teacher. Maybe you've heard him speak, Alex. And I would say that's a really sweet spot in my life to be able to share that with him. And I'm a licensed independent, I laugh every time I say this, licensed independent clinical social worker, lots of words, which just means that I'm a social worker who does therapy. And I think that's all I'll say about myself. So if you're interested in any of that, I'd be happy to talk with you after the talk. So I introduced myself, but I didn't introduce my friends that I brought along with me today. I have a bison here, and I have Kuan Yin, who's the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And so the bison and Kuan Yin sit next to my cushion at home, and they're reminders to me of two qualities that I really am trying to cultivate, the bison steadfastness and kind of courage in the face of it all, and Kuan Yin meeting what we're facing with compassion. And if you're a bison fan, I'd love to talk about bison later. Their bison are amazing. And here we are in the prairie with bison. So the title of my talk today is Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. My partner suggested that I might start the talk by singing it, but since I can't carry a tune and I don't really know all the words, I'm sparing you that pleasure. I'd hoped that Merle Haggard had sung it and then I could dedicate it to him, but I couldn't find that he had. But it's been a tune that's been running through my head. You know how those things get stuck in there? And so I thought I would engage it in this talk. They say all Dharma talks are about the same thing. I've heard probably hundreds of Dharma talks, as probably you have too. I just came back from Spirit Rock where I heard 56 Dharma talks. And that was the sixth year I've done it, so I can't do the math, but that's a lot. And I think it's true. All Dharma talks are the same. And yet we have to be in the right place to hear what's being said. We can hear something over and over and over again, and then one day it just kind of gets in. And so I'm going to talk about some of what got in over the last 2 months on this retreat. And I'm also going to speak only from my personal experience, so that is the other suggestion. I don't know whether it's a suggestion. The other advice that one is given about Dharma talks is never speak about something you haven't experienced. So this is something that I've been working with for quite a while. And I hope you will bear with me. I'm going to read most of it because I have a bad memory. And then when I leave, it's like, oh, why didn't I remember to say that? So I'll try not to make it too dry. So how many times have you thought of, if I only had X, my life would be so much better? Whatever that X might be, a different partner, a better house, a faster computer, more time to meditate. You can think to yourself what it is that X represents for you. And I probably think that maybe 20 times a day, if I were honest, maybe more, I just don't notice it. And if you really pay attention when you're thinking that, you can kind of feel the pull outside of yourself to some place where life might be better, where your body mind would be less deficient or improved in some way. So I'm going to read a passage from Arthur Miller's After the Fall. Speaks to this. I think it's a mistake to ever look for hope, or you could say love, outside of oneself. One day the house smells of fresh bread, the next of smoke and blood. One day you faint because the gardener cuts his or her finger. Within a week, you're climbing over the corpses of children bombed in the subway. What hope can there be if this is so? I tried to die near the end of the war. He's speaking of World War II. The same dream returned each night until I dared not go to sleep and I became quite ill. I dreamed I had a child, and even in the dream I saw it was my life. And it was an idiot, and I ran away. But it always crept over my lap again, clutched at my clothes, until I thought, if I could kiss it, whatever it in it was my own, perhaps I could sleep. And I bent to its broken face, and it was horrible, but I kissed it. I think one must finally take one's life in one's arms. I think one must finally take one's life in one's arms. So Sri Nisargadatta, I believe that's how you pronounce the name. I may just call him Sri N from now on. He's someone whose teachings show up a lot in places like this. He was a teacher and practitioner of non-dualism in India. The end of the 19th century, beginning and middle of the 20th century. He wrote a book called I Am That. And he was a spiritual seeker, and he was a shopkeeper, and he was an amazing man. So he taught that this pushing away, this rejection of our lives, creates an abyss. An abyss or a chasm between our small sense of self and our lives and other people. And this disconnection leaves us feeling isolated, unworthy, dissatisfied. And that really speaks to me. I mean, for years I've been trying to figure out how to feel completely connected to other people. It's like I thought I could think my way into this. And it wasn't until I realized that what I needed to do was to turn my attention back inside and to begin to love myself that then the barriers broke down between me and others. Perhaps you've had this experience. So he wrote in I Am That, and the English is a little unusual. I assume it was translated from an Indian language. So listen carefully. All you need is already within you. Only you must approach yourself with reverence and love. Self-condemnation and self-distrust are grievous errors. Your constant flight from pain and search for pleasure is a sign of the love you bear for yourself. All I plead with you is this. Make love of yourself perfect. Deny yourself nothing. Give yourself infinity and eternity to discover that you do not need them. You are beyond. I'll read it again. All you need is already within you, only you must approach yourself with reverence and love. Self-condemnation and distrust are grievous errors. Your constant flight from pain and search for pleasure is a sign of the love you bear for yourself. All I plead with you is this. Make love of yourself perfect. Deny yourself nothing. Give yourself infinity and eternity to discover that you do not need them. That's self-condemnation and self-distrust. You are beyond. So one of the lines in this that really strikes me is, your constant flight from pain and search for pleasure is a sign of the love you bear for yourself. I think for years I thought that my constant flight from pain and search for desire was a deep flaw, something that I had to eradicate. It was a sign of my deficiencies as a practitioner and as a human being. But that's not what he's saying. So if you use the language of Buddhism, greed, anger, and delusion, the three defilements, I don't like that word, but greed, anger, and delusion, the unwholesome mind states, our constant flight from pain and search for pleasure are not fatal flaws. They are nothing more than attempts to find happiness, however deluded. And somebody said that to me on this past retreat. It was like, wow, really? They are the normal human response to what are called the three characteristics. So constant change or impermanence, the absence of a fixed self, and the unsatisfactoriness of all conditioned phenomena. So those are pretty hard to deal with, right? These three characteristics. And so we naturally respond out of greed, anger, and delusion because it's hard. We can see this operating on a personal level, and we can see this operating on a global level. All you need to do is think about terrorists. I mean, in their own deluded way, they're trying to deal with impermanence, change, things that they can't understand. So to put it another way, the whole of this practice is giving back to nature that which we have mistakenly appropriated as our own. Giving back to nature what we have mistakenly appropriated as our own. So greed, anger, and delusion, or the desire to have things be different than they are, arise naturally in response to the conditions of life. They are the natural response to suffering by those whom the Buddha called the uninstructed worldlings. I include myself with that category. He meant beings who are unaware of the path to freedom as he laid it out in the Four Noble Truths. And even for those who follow the path, these qualities of greed, anger, and delusion, they still arise under the right circumstances, until we reach the end of the path. So instead of criticizing ourselves, then, we might try seeing the suffering that arises from the desire to have things be different as a teacher and offer thanks. These are the words of Anthony DeMello. Anthony DeMello was a Jesuit priest. He was born in Mumbai, and he practiced insight meditation as part of his spiritual path. He died in, I believe, 1981, and he was excoriated by the Catholic Church. And he wrote a beautiful little book. This one is literally little, The Way to Love. So these are his words. Look at everything that you think and feel and say and do that you do not like in yourself. your negative emotions, your defects, your handicaps, your errors, your attachments and neuroses and hang-ups? Can you see every one of them as a necessary part of your development, holding out a promise of growth and grace for you and others that would never have been there except for this thing that you so disliked? And if you have caused pain and negative feelings in others, were you not at that moment a teacher to them, an instrument that offered them a seed for self-discovery and growth? Can you persist in this observation until you see all of this as a happy fault, a necessary sin that brings so, he uses sin, he's Christian, sin that brings so much good to you and to the world? If you can, your heart will be flooded with peace and gratitude and love and acceptance of every single thing. And you will be you will have discovered what people everywhere are searching for and never find, namely the fountainhead of serenity and joy that hides in every human heart. So he's speaking to seeing our things that we would label as hang-ups or attachments as a gift. Can we take the parts of us that we'd rather not acknowledge in our arms, as Arthur Miller suggests, and offer ourselves compassion and gratitude? They too are deserving of our kindness. So the words of the Buddha, if you search the world over, you will find no one more worthy of your love than yourself. He didn't say, if you search the world over, you will find no one more worthy of love than certain parts of yourself. He was talking about the whole shebang. The Buddha also said that the whole of his teachings could be summed up by the admonition, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to. So this includes ideas about who we are, feelings of worthiness or unworthiness, and even the very concept of a fixed self, a me, that needs love from others. So we come to understand this not by trying to figure it out with our heads intellectually, but experientially. By paying close attention to our moment-by-moment experience, by bearing witness to our suffering, and getting to know what it feels like to be caught in self-doubt and condemnation, and what it feels like to be free of that. And also by noticing that these mind states, like everything, are conditioned. They arise and pass away like everything else in nature. They are impersonal, they are impermanent, and they are unsatisfactory, but they are not me. Giving up our self-concepts and all the ways that we think we're inadequate and opening to self-love can be kind of scary. It's not familiar to many of us. Many of us have been taught from an early age that we should believe otherwise, constant improvement, changing the things that aren't right. If we love ourselves just as we are now, what will happen? Will we become narcissistic? Will we become lazy or something equally as bad? Giving up our attachment to others' love and admiration can be even scarier. This is what the Metta Sutta and the practice of loving kindness invites us to do. In fact, fear is often the biggest impediment to the deepest love of others, a love that is not dependent on reciprocity or personal gain. If we love others as they are, without the expectation of return, who will be there for us? That was something I really pondered a lot on this past retreat. I was practicing the generosity of letting go. So I'll just tell the story around that. So I'd been sitting for 6 weeks, and then the last 2 weeks, my own son came in as the teacher. And I was watching my mind, wanting to be special, wanting to be seen, wanting him to say, oh, there's my mother sitting in the, you know. And of course, he didn't say any of that. And I just watched myself get smaller and smaller and needy. And it was such an instructive thing, very painful. And so I just practiced what it was like to let go of needing to have that role, of being recognized. I mean, I know he loves me, but he wasn't recognizing me in the way that I wanted to be special. And so it was a very, very powerful lesson in what it is like to love without attachment. I think that's the hardest thing with the people that we're closest to. So these are the words of Anthony DeMello again. It is only in aloneness, in utter solitude, that dependence and desire die, and the capacity to love is born. And only someone who has attempted this knows the terror of this process. And I would say that I experienced terror. It was truly terror at giving it up. It is like inviting yourself to die. It is asking the poor drug addict to give up the only happiness he has known, in other words, attachment to others, and replace it with a taste for bread and fruit and clean, fresh morning air and the sweetness of water from the mountain stream while he is struggling to cope with his withdrawal symptoms and the emptiness that he experiences within himself now that his drug is gone. If you ever get to this state, you will at last know what it means to see with a vision that is clear and unclouded by fear or desire. And you will know what it means to love. And to come to this land of love, you will have to pass through the pains of death. For to love persons is to have died to the need for persons and to be utterly alone. So this is the hero's journey. Loving ourselves and loving others without dependence or desire requires courage. Fear is the natural response to the unknown, and when it arrives, it deserves our full compassion. Only then will it eventually subside. So the Bison and Kuan Yin are up there to support in this process, the courage to be steadfast and the compassion to meet it. Because fear is part of our animal nature, it will arise. It is not us. We need to offer ourselves compassion in a visceral or a physical way, a way that calms this natural animal response to threat and helps us to relax on the journey. We often can't talk our way out of it, think about our way out of it. It needs to be physical. By doing so, we are better able to hold the fear in the space of awareness and remind ourselves that we need to give back to nature that which is nature. So one of the things that I've recently been doing is teaching mindful self-compassion, and that starts out with just the physical, the visceral sense of offering ourselves compassion to quell the fear, to quell the fear of being human. So I'd like to end by bringing us through a guided meditation that hopefully you'll have the chance to experience some of this. So I invite you again to find a comfortable sitting posture. And directing your attention once again to the felt sense of this body, this animal, natural body, and to the breath. Feeling the breath coming into the body and the breath leaving the body. Nature doing what it does naturally. And noticing any resistance to what you are finding moment to moment. Any leaning forward or pulling away. any wanting things to be different than they are. Sensing if there is anything in this moment that stands in the way of you and loving presence. Anything that is between you and the life that is presenting itself right now. And noticing if this wanting things to be different than they are is met with self-criticism. I shouldn't be feeling this way. And if this is so, feeling what it feels like in your body and mind and heart, this rejection, this pushing away. Feeling its effect on your sense of connection to yourself and even to the others in this room. And if you find a sense of disconnection, of suffering, offering this animal body compassion, perhaps by placing your hand or your hands on your heart, or feeling the touch of your hand or hands elsewhere on your body. Having the intention to hold all of you down to the last cell in benevolent awareness. Looking for love in all the right places. So I want to end with a poem. And it's got two voices in it. So I'm going to ask for a volunteer. Anybody want to? Okay, thank you. So I'll give you the mic. Is that okay? And so you are going to be the voice of tech support. Yes. Okay. It'll be a stretch? Okay. So this is called Love 2.0, and the author is unknown.
Yes, ma'am. How can I help you?
Well, after much consideration, I've decided to install Love. Can you guide me through the process?
Yes, I can help you. Are you ready to proceed?
Well, I'm not very technical, but I think I'm ready. What do I do first?
The first step is to open your heart. Have you located your heart, ma'am?
Yes, but there are several other programs running now. Is it okay? Is it okay to install Love while they're running?
What programs are you running, ma'am?
Let's see. I have past hurt, low self-esteem, grudge, and resentment running right now.
No problem. Love will gradually ease past hurt from your current operating system. It will remain in your permanent memory, but it will no longer disrupt other programs. Love will eventually override low self-esteem with a module of its own called high self-esteem. However, you have to completely turn off grudge and resentment. Those programs prevent love from being properly installed. Can you turn those off, ma'am?
I don't know how to turn them off. Can you tell me how?
With pleasure. Go to your start menu and invoke forgiveness. Do this as many times as necessary until grudge and resentment have completely erased.
Okay, done. Love has started installing itself. Is that normal?
Yes. But remember that you have only the base program. You need to begin connecting to other hearts in order to get the upgrades.
Whoops, I have an error message already. It says, error, program not run on external components. What should I do?
Don't worry, ma'am. It means the love program is set up to run on internal hearts, but has not yet been run on your own heart. In non-technical terms, it means you have to love yourself before you can love others.
So what should I do?
Can you pull down self-acceptance? Then click on the following. Forgive self. Realize your worth. Acknowledge your limitations.
Okay, done.
That was fast. Now copy them to My Heart Directory. The system will overwrite any conflicting files and begin patching faulty programming. Also, you need to delete verbose self-criticism from all directories and empty a recycle bin to make sure it is completely gone and never comes back.
Got it. Hey, my heart is filling up with new files. Smile is playing on my monitor, and peace and contentment are copying themselves all over my heart. Is this normal?
Sometimes. For others, it takes a while, but eventually everything gets downloaded at the proper time. So love is installed and running. One more thing before we hang up. Love is freeware. Be sure to give it and its various modules to everyone you meet. They will in turn share it with others and return some cool modules back to you.
I promise to do just that. Thank you. So we have an indeterminate amount of time, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10, for questions and answers if there's anything anyone would like to ask or share from their own experience. So I'll pass the mic back if you just turn it on when you get it. The author of the poem is unknown. If you want a copy of it, you can go to Lee Brasington's website. Brasington. He's a longtime teacher, Dharma teacher, and he also had a career in computers. And you'll find it on his website, Love 2.0. Oh, there's one over here.
Megan, there's one thing I was thinking about during. Oh, probably 3 or 4 years ago. I remember the first day of my psychiatry rotation. We were like totally fresh, didn't know anything, and they gave us a handout. And at the top, it was like, if there's one thing you learn on this rotation, it's validation. And it was all in caps. And like they said, you know, it's the most, like, I think something that we underestimate a lot, but it's the most powerful thing that we can do when we don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And so I see that as being true in terms of like self-validation of your experience. And I often tie it in with like self-honesty about like, oh, this is actually really hard and like validating that. But it's really powerful too when you're interacting with other people. Like it almost kind of, I think it stops the proliferation of the views of what's happening and it really changes things. So I think that is kind of what you're saying.
Thank you. I remember one of my social work teachers taught me that if you can't think of anything to say, just say something kind.
Boy, I hope I can articulate this right, but what you say makes just a lot of sense to me. And I experience a lot two things. The fear of my own judgment is stronger than the things, the deficiencies that I see in myself. And it's kind of an odd thing because I remember about a month and a half, 2 months ago, Mark said, those moments where you realize you have that icky feeling because of whatever reason, he called those spiritual gold. Mm-hmm. And it made a lot of sense to me because I have found that if I can, when I have those moments and I can stay with them, coming out on the other end is insight. In fact, it's actually gentle insight, even compassionate insight. And so I, in some funny ways, I kind of look, look forward to those moments because there's some real good insight that comes out of it. But there's the other side of me who sees those things that cause those icky feelings, and it's very judgmental. And it's like they're two different things. In fact, I try to reason why I shouldn't be so judgmental on myself, and guess what? It doesn't do any good. You know, I know better, but I do it. But so I don't know. It's just a thing that I've seen is the judging seems to be a thing unto itself, its own harshness, and the events that, you know, sometimes trigger it have their own reality and own treatment to them. So,
thank you. So that judge is trying to help us often, right? It thinks it has a role.
I suppose, in a funny way, it's like the judging, I dislike it so much, I'm also afraid of it, that it's almost its own thing that I have to stay with, regardless of whatever brings it on. It's like it's its own, and this may be just simply something that's part of my own package, but it's just like, it's just something I think, as I think about it, something I have to stay with and learn from it. It's just deeply embedded. It's, you know, like probably like most of us, it's there, ready and willing to show itself. And my desire to want to shut it off is natural, but it's not the thing to do. It's just learning to sit with it. It's a long-term project, right? So
And you can do it. You can titrate it. You don't need to do it all at once.
That's right. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the talk. I think that this is hard for me. There's so much practice and so much ease in being able to come up with judgments, you know, that good enough versus not good enough and like tainted love. It seems all tainted. So it's, you know, I try to be unguarded in the moment, but so much of what's formed into causes and conditions for me are you know, absent of, like, the seeds, you know, like trying to even evoke a memory of being loved. I think it's like digging through really, really solid ground, you know. It's like really freaking hard. And I have insight into it, you know, in that I can see that, like, I seek it externally and it always pisses me off, you know, so it's like unsatisfactory. But then you try internally and you find a lacking there, you know, you find like almost like there's nothing really to hold on to. And if you do find anything, it's that narcissism, which is different than what we're talking about. It's not about, oh, I'm so great. It's different. It's more developed. And so I think I get confused around what the F am I doing? Because I feel like I'm whistling in the dark. Mm-hmm. I get sick of whistling. It's fun for a little bit, but then it gets old.
Thank you. So in my experience, again, the physical sense of love was the door. I couldn't think my way into it. I couldn't remember anything, but I could feel what it felt like. Yeah. So if you haven't tried that, you might try.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.